You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of September 2014, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Tyler Brulé. On today's show, I'll be joined in studio by John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, and James Boyce, senior visiting fellow at King's College here in London. And we will be discussing the day's key news stories from around the world. First up, we'll be taking a look at the pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong, which continue to grip the city.
Tonight, it's the eve of National Day, the founding of the People's Republic of China. And there are tens of thousands and possibly more than 100,000 on the street already. And it's an incredible atmosphere.
I'll also be asking whether the Secret Service needs to reassess their security protocol after a knife-wielding intruder gained access to the White House.
While notable improvements have been made to the security of the White House complex, there have been several priority improvements desired by the service that have not been possible in light of other considerations or given the level of funding provided to the agency for such capital improvements.
There you go. Former Secret Service Director Ralph Basham speaking there. And
rhythm is a dancer. I need a companion. Girl, I guess that must be you.
I'm going to be joined by Gary Trust of Billboard magazine for a weekly music review. All that, plus I'll be checking in with our man in Copenhagen, and I'll be taking a trip into the French countryside with author Dave Golson. All that to come in Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. And with the clock about to hit 18:02 here in Studio One at Midori House, it means it's time for the world news.
Monocle 24 News with Jonathan Wheatley. Tens of thousands of pro-democracy protesters have extended a blockade of Hong Kong streets ahead of what some fear may be a push by police to clear the roads before Chinese National Day on Wednesday. The demonstrations are in anger at Chinese plans to vet candidates for the 2017 elections. In Taiwan, where similar pro-democracy protests have taken place in the past, the main opposition party, the Democratic Progressive Party, is urging authorities in Hong Kong and Beijing to show restraint. Joseph Wu is the DPP's Secretary General.
Fundamental rights, such as the freedom of assembly and freedom of expression, should be protected. The DPP calls for both the Hong Kong and Chinese governments to exercise self-restraint in dispersing the peaceful demonstrations taking place. We ask that they listen with diligence and respond positively to the views that have been expressed.
The former Bosnian Serb political leader Radovan Karadzic's armed forces deliberately killed civilians to spread terror, war crimes prosecutors said today as his trial draws to a close. Prosecutors at the International Criminal Court in The Hague are seeking the maximum penalty of life imprisonment against Karadzic, who faces charges of genocide for the killing of more than 8,000 Muslim men and boys from Srebrenica, Europe's worst massacre since the Second World War. Police in the Australian state of Victoria have raided a number of properties in Melbourne as part of a security crackdown on radical Islamists. Officials believe some have been planning attacks in the country. Australia is supporting the US-led action against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria and is monitoring possible militants returning to Australia from the fighting. One man was arrested in the latest raids. Well, Neil Gorgon is the Assistant Commissioner of Australia's Federal Police.
The operation today involved in excess of 100 members of the Victorian Police and Australian Federal Police. The search warrants were the culmination of an 8-month investigation named Operation Holzen-Salzburg, which began following information provided by the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation. Yep. It actually funded someone to travel from the US to Syria, and that person, we were alleged, is currently fighting in Syria.
Meanwhile, Turkey has taken in more than 150,000 Kurds who fled from Syria as Islamic State advances, but authorities have not yet agreed to a role in the US-led action against the militants. 46 Turkish men who were being held hostage by the group were released last weekend, and Monocle's Caleb Lauer, who's in Istanbul, says that may help Ankara to act.
On the same weekend, ISIS launched this major attack against a town right on Turkey's border. Those developments and the attack led to up to 200,000 refugees fleeing into Turkey. Those developments have really sort of changed the scene in terms of Turkey's position.
Some finance news now, and Eurozone inflation slowed again in September as some food and energy prices fell, reinforcing expectations that the European Central Bank will ease policy further and sending the euro to a two-year low. Eurostat said on Tuesday that consumer prices in the 18 countries sharing the euro rose 0.3% year-on-year, less than the 0.4% increases seen in August and July. The September reading was in line with market forecasts. And finally, in Canada, a Quebec judge has today sided with a woman who paid for a parrot autopsy and demanded to be reimbursed nearly $4,000 Canadian from the pet store that sold her the sick bird that died 3 months later. The parrot, who was called Sam, normally has a 20-year lifespan, but in a scene similar to a Monty Python sketch, the store refused to give 26-year-old Melinda Herbert her money back because it said the parrot could have been dropped or otherwise injured for all it knew. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. I'm glad the Canadian courts are keeping nice and busy, particularly the Quebec courts. Right. Anyway, Jonathan is going to be back in about 24 minutes' time. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back in a moment. Stay with us.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se om Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, just 18.07. Here in London, if you're listening in Taipei, it's 1.07. And joining me now in studio with her take on the news of the day is John Everard, regular to this program, former British ambassador to North Korea, and James Boyce, senior visiting fellow at King's College here in London. Gentlemen, welcome. Now, in a moment, we're going to be talking about, of course, the invasion of the White House. Some probably listeners noticed that there was a sort of a slight invasion in the studio just as we were going to break. And we should probably also then start off with sort of insurrections of some sort, maybe kicking off gentlemen just in Hong Kong. And I guess, you know, certainly probably from your perspective, John, this is kind of largely been at least part of your neighborhood when you were based out in that part of the world. I want to know just how you've watched this unfold over the last day, and I guess particularly from a speed perspective as well. Is it playing out faster or slower than one might have expected?
It's playing out a lot faster. I mean, a lot of people have commented that this is just not like Hong Kong. Hong Kong is an intensely conservative, really in some ways quite slow-moving society. But these protests have spread like wildfire. Not only is it faster than most people have expected, it's clearly much faster than the Hong Kong leadership has been able to cope with, and much faster than Beijing is comfortable with. The stuff coming out of Beijing right now, especially in some of the more nationalist outlets, is really quite scary, suggesting that the whole thing has been fermented by outside powers, and suggesting also that what the protesters are asking for, which you and I might call democracy, would actually plunge the whole China into chaos very quickly. It's quite scary stuff.
James, have you read it so far?
It's fascinating. John's been out there. I had family connections out there some years ago, and I'm quite sure that the Beijing authorities must be cursing Chris Patton, wherever he is today, for introducing the seed of democracy as the last governor over there. I think one of the things that many people perhaps in Europe don't appreciate necessarily is the geography here. If you look at the imagery that comes out, it looks like it might just be based in Central, and you've heard references to Occupy Central, but the fact that this is now spreading through Wan Chai, Admiralty, over into Kowloon side, you know, this is clearly growing, you know, like a virus effectively around Hong Kong. It's generating appetites. It began as an Occupy Central concept. We were talking before we came on air, the idea that there's student groups involved, there's employment rights group involved. It's evolving beyond what it was that the original aspirations were, to a point where the appetites it's devouring are almost going to become uncontrollable. And one wonders how controllable these protests are. There's talk about trying to get off the streets by Wednesday. Mm. That's now almost that time now in Hong Kong. Whether they follow the leadership of this group is going to be very interesting to discover.
Mm. Do you think, John, that this has been read slightly wrong, that maybe in Beijing, some forces have been sitting there thinking, well, this is Hong Kong. As long as business is ticking over and everyone's shop fronts are open and the flights are coming in and out of the airport, then everything is fine. And that has to be the prevailing mood of the place. And everyone's just going to sort of get angry and get on with business. That's why Hong Kong is there. So has there sort of been a misstep on the strategy side if you're sitting in Beijing?
No, firstly, I don't think that is what Beijing will be thinking. I think they'll be looking at these protests and that the blood will be draining from their faces.
Mm.
They are in the middle of a complex rebalancing, to borrow a word from elsewhere, in China. They're trying to cut down on corruption, and they've made it clear that while this is going on, there is going to be no political reform. And yet here they have all these protesters in what is still officially Chinese territory, throwing caution to the winds and demanding full democracy. Now, firstly, it's worrying for Beijing that this might happen in Hong Kong. It's even more worrying that the contagion might spread. They've gone to huge lengths to prevent news of what is going on spreading into the mainland. And of course, they're going to lose that battle. News is going to reach a lot of Chinese, and there's going to be a kind of mimic effect. But what will worry Beijing most of all is Taiwan.
Mm.
The one bit of China's foreign policy that has been going reasonably well for a few years, the relationship with Taiwan, is now at risk. Because Taiwanese, especially if there's any kind of crackdown on these protests in Hong Kong, will say, if that's what China's
deals
like,
off. Yeah.
Deals off, yes.
Yeah. James, from a business point of view, and very hard to, of course, separate Beijing from the Hong Kong equation right now, but does this have a sort of a fuse time as well before people also, you know, it's interesting, we're at that time of year when a lot of major corporations are, let's say, balancing up office headcount in Hong Kong versus Singapore, for example.
Sure.
So does that start to impact things as well? You know, suddenly you have a major multinational, you know, financial services company. They say, yeah, you know what? I think we just might need to take an extra two floors in Singapore versus Hong Kong.
It's not impossible. I think what's fascinating here is I was talking about a little earlier, the idea that this protest movement is developing appetites. There are more people getting involved in this. There's now an element involved in this, which is talking about employment rights over there and the look for more work. Of course, the great problem that's going to have an impact upon future direction of business over there is going to be very dependent upon what the Chinese government does next.
Mm.
You know, if they decide to move in on very shortly what after would be the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square movement and have a crackdown, if international business sees anything coming down on this which is going to somehow curtail rights for democracy and have a knock-on effect for business, then that, I think, is certainly going to drive business to other locations in the region.
Mm. John, do we have any sense of how much Beijing is really on the ground in Hong Kong? Are you looking at a situation where someone is standing, you know, in the government buildings overlooking all of this and really sort of calling the shots from the 36th floor? Or is it, you know, is it a control room with lots of tie lines to Beijing?
There, I think it could swing from one to the other depending on what's going on. CY Leung's links with Beijing are declared and very close indeed. I think how far is Beijing involved on the ground? I mean, one important point to remember, I think, is that whereas in previous protests in Hong Kong, none of which have been as big as this, the things against which the protesters have clamoured have been initiated by the Hong Kong government so that Beijing was able to authorise change without too much loss of face, just by quietly instructing the Hong Kong government to change its stance. This time it's different. This time, the restrictions on democracy in the 2017 elections were actually announced by the National People's Congress in Beijing. So Beijing has hardly any wriggle room, and it's going to be really hard to find Beijing a ladder to climb down and keep its face on this one.
I guess going back just a little bit earlier, James, you're talking about also how this is gaining momentum. We're not talking about something which is, you know, confined, you know, certainly to central. It's in many other places. You know, if it, you know, do we get to a place and is there almost a critical choke point, sort of the famous roundabout when you come out of the airport? If that starts to be occupied, you know, do we see a more not just expansive, even a more aggressive stance in terms of where this moves geographically within a very small territory.
It's entirely possible. Again, you know, 25 years ago, people were clamouring around a papier-mâché image of the Statue of Liberty. Now I understand that music from Les Miserables is being used by the what's being referred to as the Umbrella Revolution over there. This idea that a lot of this has been driven, it seems, by initial Chinese crackdown. The people have seen the tear gas being used. It's driven people onto the streets who might not otherwise have been there. There's clearly issues of generational splits there. But if you start moving around from area within area of Hong Kong, from Central Admiralty, Wan Chai, if you head over to the airport, you know, you were talking about business earlier on. If people look at this and think, hang on, the city is choked up. You can't physically get around there. That's going to have an impact. And I think, you know, drive, you know, the direction of this forward in a way that really is at this point unimaginable, I think.
Just before we move on, we'll talk about events vis-a-vis US and Argentina in a moment. But just last point, John, you know, on that, I guess when you talk about officials and having sort of all of the blood drained out of their faces, knowing the neighborhood reasonably well, do you have a sense? Does it get a little bit hotter, or does it sort of cool down by weekend? Do you think?
I think by weekend. I don't think we've seen the hottest point yet. I think there's more temperature rises to come. I expect by the weekend, though, that a lot of the protesters will have returned to work. Some protesters will probably have been asked to stand down by their leadership. What, of course, isn't clear is how far the leaders of the protest can actually control now what is going on the ground. I think it's taken on a life of its own.
Let's just move on. This was something that started to really break probably last night. Many people probably tucked up in bed, certainly in Asia and Europe as well. U.S. judge, of course, ruled that Argentina is in contempt of court for refusing to obey an order to repay the debt it owes two large U.S. hedge funds. It's the latest development in the case brought by the U.S. hedge funds, who, of course, bought the country's debt at a discount in 2001. Argentina has long been at odds with the decisions, certainly those handed down by the U.S. courts over these so-called vulture funds. So it's a question, I mean, how are they going to deal with this latest judgment? And James, let me start with you. I mean, if you're Ms. Kirshner, do you sort of just ignore it and sort of be hot-headed and passionate about it? How does it go?
That sounds like a very Argentine response to me, quite frankly. Absolutely. I mean, talk about living in a globalized world where there's no borders. I mean, here you have an American judge talking about holding a nation in contempt of court. I mean, who would ever have thought such a thing? Let's be honest about it. How is this going to be enforced? I suppose they could say, well, we're going to charge you more money, but Argentina is already in debt anyway. So what are they going to do? Just add it to the line of credit that's owed to Argentina. We were talking before we came on air, and I know John is very familiar with this part of the world, so I'm looking forward to his take on this in particular. But when you have a country which is indebted like this, it really is uncharted territory, I think, when you have a federal judge effectively making this ruling. But if you're Argentina, what are you going to do? Just almost laugh at it, I think, I would have thought.
Well, yeah, you were a British ambassador to Montevideo. Would you be a little bit hesitant if you were the CEO of Aerolíneas Argentinas, thinking, we sent an aircraft into the States, they're going to impound one of our A340s? Now, that's not even, of course, to take care of, even a fraction of this. But how do you think this plays out? I mean, do they have to be sort of quite concerned about state assets that are getting anywhere close to U.S. airspace or certainly on U.S. soil?
They have a great deal to be concerned about. Yes, state assets anywhere near U.S. soil or anywhere near soil on which a U.S. court can execute judgment. Which is quite a lot of soil. They are also very worried about the effect that this will have on anybody who might previously have thought of either investing in or lending to Argentina. And after the judgment was passed, there was a few hours of kind of shocked silence. And the Argentine press is now bubbling with rude words about the US court system, claiming, of course, that this is all political stitch-up and that the vulture funds are thoroughly evil, buoyed in that, of course, by the ruling of the Human Rights Council last week. For all that, I mean, to come back to James's point, what happens? The funds involved are held by the Bank of New York. They're all on U.S. soil. So yes, a U.S. court can simply attach fines to those funds. It can bleed Argentina if he wants to.
And I mean, just both of you very quickly before we go to a break, from a brand point of view, this is, in many ways, yes, Argentina is a place we might like to drink their wine, lovely landscape, and certainly a great place to go on holiday and many other things. You know, and, you know, despite everything that, you know, and it's a little bit, of course, like, you know, there's obviously a large Italian diaspora there. Somehow, you know, the place does manage to function. You know, there are cut through interesting family businesses, etc. But when you look at sort of, you know, brand halo, nation brand halo, you know, the fact that the government's behaving this way, you know, what does it do for your country?
It doesn't exactly say scream out, come here, invest in us, does it, quite frankly? You know, it's fascinating when you look at how it is that this situation has been dealt with, and you put it into context, and you look at how, for example, the Clinton administration dealt with the Mexican peso crisis in the mid-1990s, for example. Very, very different way of addressing these things, far more accomplished and successful, arguably. I'm sure there are great differences, but just trying to draw some sort of parallels there with my own area of research. What you want desperately is for Argentina to be a functioning democratic state which is not seen as a pariah or held in contempt by courts, for example. Mm. It's a major international trading partner. You want it to be functioning properly, and one hopes that that day can be reached in the not too distant future.
Mm. Brand perceptions, and certainly, would you be on sort of the investor shuttle bus?
I don't think I will be putting any money into Argentina anytime soon. But then that's a view that I've held for a long time, long before this blew.
Right.
Can I just make a final point on this story? It isn't just about Argentina. If a US judge can say that a country that's in debt and has tried to restructure has to pay holdouts, this affects everybody who tries to restructure their debts. And there's an awful lot of them across Latin America. Effectively, it means, and this could be very bad news for a lot of Latin American governments, that if you borrow money, you might actually have to pay it back.
In the studio, sorry, okay, half last word. Yeah. In the studio with me today, James Boyce, senior visiting fellow at King's College here in London, also John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, also, as we just found out, to Uruguay as well. You're listening to Midori House. We're going to continue this discussion right after this.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you are listening to Midori House, 1822 here in London. And we left on topic in Latin America. But gentlemen, I want to just bring up a piece that we caught our eye in the Nikkei Asian Review. And it was a story, one of the editors, contributors, sort of arguing about the Russia-Chinese relationship. Says, you know, it appears there's, of course, a cozy relationship brewing between China and Russia. The two countries have, you know, been long-time diplomatic and, of course, economic allies. But now some analysts also say that Russia wants to take that relationship to another level as it moves towards China's economic and social policies. So, of course, big question. Some would say it was ever thus, at least at some level. But I guess a former view of a man who was in Pyongyang, how do you read that? Do we see a lot more meetings, whether at, at a public sector, private sector level happening in Vladivostok, Khabarovsk, etc.?
I frankly am not betting any money on this. It's clear that Russia is seeking a close relationship with China. The problem is, to go back to Latin America, it takes two to tango. And China is not showing any signs of wanting that close relationship with Russia, a country with which China right now is deeply dismayed, because China depends on a peaceful, orderly world environment to prosper. And here we have Russia going and kicking people around in Ukraine. The Chinese really don't like that. And after Putin's great visit to Beijing, remember all the fanfares of trumpets and all the high-level deals and all this stuff, the Chinese silence over Ukraine is deafening. Not a word of support for Russia. Moreover, what would this relationship actually look like? China is getting the gas and natural resources all it wants from essentially Central Asia. Russia can add more, but not until pipelines are built in several years' time. And China knows that if it gets into bed too deeply with Russia, it is going to start alienating other gas-producing states with which it's had close relationships and it's cultivated carefully. So there's a lot of caution in Beijing. But I think the Russia-China relationship is one of those things that some analysts think ought to be happening, but in fact really isn't.
So is this just a view from Tokyo then, whether it's the Japanese foreign ministry stirring up newspapers as well? Japan, James, has territorial issues, of course, not just with China, but also the Russians as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one needs to be always mindful of who's writing, why they might be writing. We've clearly got a Japanese writer here talking about his concerns about the shift as he sees it driving Russia and China together. You know, during the Cold War and the early years of that, Washington analysts always used to talk about the Soviet Sino-bloc as though both were driven out of Moscow, for example. That would seem to be somewhat fanciful and sort of demolished effectively by Nixon Kissinger's triangular diplomacy. I think one of the problems you're facing here, though, is the idea that perhaps there's a perception that Putin is playing a long-term strategy which fits in with this idea that he's going to be in power for a long time, with fears that if you look at the Western perspective, because of how the American democratic system is set up, it very much rewards short-term thinking. Obama's out of office in two short years' time. Who's setting long-term strategy? The problem you've got, obviously, is that we can impose all the sanctions we like upon Russia, but Russia has ways of pushing back. And it's perhaps more, as John was saying, in Russia's interest to cozy up to China than it is in China's interest to cozy up to Moscow. But one way, I think the only people who are going to lose out at this rate are potentially going to be the poor people in Ukraine and potentially those of us who are paying energy bills in Western Europe.
And John, just before we move on, is it also perhaps a situation we've seen incursions by Russian aircraft, released, straying very close to Japanese airspace, etc., of late. That's certainly flared things up slightly. So do we see Moscow just a little bit more interested in its Far East suddenly?
I don't think it's just the Far East. I think pushing out in all directions, Russia has become much harder and much more aggressive. And this, of course, is all to do with the changes taking place in Russia, where Putin is an avowed supporter of the old Soviet way of doing things. On sanctions, just to come back to James's point, Russia can push back to a certain extent, but the West really can hurt Russia on sanctions. And long term, the cost to Putin for his Ukraine adventure is going to be huge. And I think Putin knows that.
Yeah. Just before we go, if you look at any monitor upstairs anywhere, all U.S. channels, I mean, even Al Jazeera, everyone else, are all over the story about this intrusion. Reports in U.S. media today reveal that a man wielding a knife broke into the White House earlier this month. The intruder made his way into the ceremonial east room of the building after overpowering a Secret Service agent inside the North Portico entrance. And of course, then this incident and a series of other security embarrassments were a subject of course, a congressional hearing today, where the director of the Secret Service, Julia Pearson, faced a grilling from lawyers. Here's some of what she had to say.
I'm here today to address the concern that we all share following the incident of September 19th at the White House. It's clear that our security plan was not properly executed. This is unacceptable, and I take full responsibility, and I will make sure that it does not happen again. As director, my primary concern is ensuring the operational readiness of my workforce. I have been aggressive in addressing our human capital challenges, ensuring professionalism and developing leaders. Through active engagement with the agency's supervisors and employees, I have made it clear my expectations for professionalism and personal accountability.
Well, there you go. Director of the Secret Service in the U.S., Julia Pearson, speaking there, also sounding like she was handing in her resignation as well. We're probably likely to see her name on many, many boards of many security companies. James, I mean, remarkable when a country which... For many internationally, is a place that we almost think twice about traveling to. Do we want to go to the whole hassle of not just getting into the country, then getting out, etc. It's a rather embarrassing situation when you talk about this. This is the epicenter, supposedly probably the most secure building in the entire country.
You're absolutely right. I mean, this woman's only been in her job a relatively short time period. She, of course, came in after the former director was basically eased out once there was issues to do with Secret Service engaging with ladies of the night during presidential visits, for example. Let's be honest, the White House has always been a target for nutters and very strange people, and I don't just mean the politicians who live there. This idea that people go to the White House to try to gain notoriety in some sort of vain attempt to assassinate a president who's rarely in the building. The fact that this chap managed to get in, go on a spree effectively around not just the East Room, but up into the Green Room as well, is remarkable. You know, there's clearly a threat to the president. But if you're the president of the United States, you know, it's a very, very poor job if you want life expectancy. The Secret Service has lost, you know, there's one in four American presidents have been assassinated, four in its history. So we've seen high-profile attempts upon the lives of presidential candidates as well as people in office. So the Secret Service record over its duration is pretty, pretty pathetic, I think, compared to such institutions in the United Kingdom.
John, as someone who has, of course, probably been assigned to various British diplomatic missions, which had also varying degrees of razor wire and security, I can't imagine that probably, Montevideo was probably the securest setup. But certainly in Pyongyang, do you sort of look at this story and think, oh, you know what, listen, you know, this could happen anywhere. Whoever's asleep on watch, it doesn't matter whether it's White House or the your most what is deemed your most secure embassy in the world.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's happened to me on several occasions. There's one I remember very clearly where I was dealing with Africa at the time, and the building was invaded by a group of protesters who were protesting against human rights abuses in Indonesia. It turned out that Foreign Office guards are not actually allowed to touch anybody who enters the building, so we sat around not touching them, and I decided the best thing was to give them all tea and biscuits, which they drank and went away.
It's important to recognise that the White House looks like quite an quaint old building, but it's a facade. There is nothing left of the old White House. It's literally a security facility with secure grounds, and the fact that this has been allowed to happen is an absolute tragedy and travesty for the Secret Service.
No, I like the tea and biscuits defense thing. It's one certainly one from a soft power point of view the US could use. Well, John Everard, former ambassador, UK ambassador to North Korea, and James Boyes, visiting fellow here at King's College. And gentlemen, thanks very much. Great to see you. You're listening to Midori House. News is coming up in a little preview right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
런던으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London. 런던으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Just slightly adrift of bottom of the hour. It's 18:32. In a moment, after these headlines, we'll be checking in with our man in Copenhagen, our correspondent Michael Booth there, and I will be taking also a trip to the meadows of France with author Dave Goulson. But before that, Jonathan Wheatley is back with the bottom of the hour headlines.
Thank you very much. Tens of thousands of pro-democracy protesters have extended a blockade of Hong Kong streets ahead of what some fear may be pushed by police to clear the roads before Chinese National Day, which is tomorrow, Wednesday. The demonstrations are in anger at Chinese plans to vet candidates for the 2017 elections. The former Bosnian Serb political leader Radovan Karadzic's armed forces deliberately killed civilians to spread terror, war crimes prosecutors said today. As his trial draws to a close, prosecutors at the International Criminal Court in The Hague are seeking the maximum penalty of life imprisonment against him. Police in the Australian state of Victoria have raided a number of properties in Melbourne as part of a security crackdown on radical Islamists. Officials believe some have been planning attacks in the country. And in business news, finance news, Eurozone inflation has slowed again in September to 0.3% as some food and energy prices fell, reinforcing expectations that the European Central Bank will ease policy further and send the euro to a two-year low. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. You are back at the top of the hour in 27 minutes time, which means it is just 19:33 in Copenhagen, 18:33 here in London, 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time to check in with the first city on that list, Copenhagen. Our correspondent, Michael Booth, is there. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening, Tyler. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. You've laid out a bit of a smorgasbord of stories here. And actually the first two, not particularly appetizing. We hear that the Worldwide Fund for Nature's new eco footprint report is out today. And Denmark's not as clean and tidy as probably everyone thinks.
Yeah, Denmark, this wonderful green pioneer with Copenhagen as the European green capital for 2014, for example, is not quite as green as it claims to be. The Worldwide Fund for Nature's Living Planet report, which comes out every 2 years, came out today and places Denmark as the fourth worst eco footprint per capita in the world. Number one is Kuwait, number two Qatar, number three United Arab Emirates, which we could all understand why they're there. And then in fourth place, we have lovely green little Denmark with its windmills and bicycles and organic produce and Noma. To put that into context, America is in 8th place and the UK is in 28th place.
So I guess one who has sort of a reasonable command of geography would say, well, they're all tiny countries, so that must play into it somehow or not. Of course, the first three are considerably smaller than Denmark, though.
Well, it's more to do with wealth. The list doesn't include any countries with under a million population, but it's more to do with Denmark is very wealthy and it consumes a lot. It doesn't have the environmentally sustainable energy sources that its neighbors Sweden and Norway have with hydroelectric power and nuclear power. They rely a lot on coal. But surprisingly, one of the culprits fingered by the Worldwide Fund for Nature is Denmark's pork industry, which we might be talking about in a second, which uses an awful lot of resources from, for example, South America, soya beans, which are pumped into their industrial produced pigs. It also is the home of Maersk Shipping, which is not a particularly clean kind of industry. Shipping is one of the dirtiest polluters of all the forms of transport. So, and I have to say, unfortunately, Denmark was number fourth the last time this list came out 2 years ago. So it hasn't really cleaned up its own act.
Mm. Let's move to the food sector in particular. There's been a listeria outbreak. It's not just a few upset tummies. There's been fatalities around this. Now, is this, if I was to turn on the DR Evening Bulletin, is this what's topping stories? Probably aside from of course the nation's dirty record as well.
Well, the dirty record on the environment is quite well down the news agenda here in Denmark, for obvious reasons. But yeah, 16 deaths from listeria since September, but most recently, and that was from processed meat products in Denmark, but then three dead this week from asparagus soup, of all things, plus a very nasty MRSA outbreak in the pork industry in Denmark, a fifth of pork products said to be infected. And that's up from like 5% 5 years ago. Something's going very, very wrong with the food supply situation in Denmark with the indigenous food industry. And it doesn't seem to be getting, people don't seem to be getting hold of it. It doesn't seem to be being sorted. And as I said, there are fatalities. But little kind of governmental leadership on this.
And is this because, in many ways, the world looks to Denmark as well as a leader when it comes to industrialization and whether that's the factory floor or it's factory farming? Now, of course, another discussion whether that's what the world aspires to. But this is, many would say that Denmark's world class at this. So is it spiraling out of control, or does this come back to the government and just a lack of oversight?
Well, I think it is the latter, yeah, Tyler. But, I mean, Denmark's pork industry is famous around the world. They have more pigs than people in Denmark, and they slaughter and produce more pork than anyone else in the world. They have the biggest slaughterhouse in the world here in Denmark. So it is supposedly the world leader in this, but it's really dropped the ball in terms of hygiene and their hygiene systems. And plus, there's a nasty whiff of cover-up happening as well in the agricultural department. Things haven't been out in the open about this. And I think people are starting to be worried about, well, what else is being covered up?
It very much sounds like an episode of Borgen that we're all familiar with.
Well, it was an episode of
That's
War.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah.
We should maybe talk about also some royal rumors. I would imagine that the news desks are quite busy at the tabloids at the red tops in Copenhagen, with news, of course, that we might see the good Queen abdicate or not.
Well, this is a rumor that has come all the way from Australia. The reason for that, of course, is the Crown Princess Mary is Australian. She's from Tasmania. And Woman's Daily in Australia has broken this story, allegedly, that the elderly Danish Queen Margrethe, the much-loved Queen Margrethe, is supposed to be considering abdicating on grounds of ill health. The palace immediately jumped to deny the story. But, you know, what with Juan Carlos of Spain doing the same thing within the last year, there is that whiff of, not regicide, but of abdication in the air. And certainly the Crown Prince and Princess have been primed and preened and pruned, ready to take on this role, and especially Princess Mary, apparently. I'm not a great royalist, so I'm not an expert on this. But the story is out there. It's been denied. Who knows?
I had the good fortune of being invited onto the royal yacht, Dannebrog, during the Olympics. Uh-huh. And it struck me when I was with Her Majesty that she was still having a good old time, you know, certainly cracking open, her lovely box of cigarettes and having very fetching sailors come and light them for her. So, I didn't strike me that she was ready to step down. What do you think? Because this, also, the Queen is also much loved, from the outside.
Unless she's seriously ill, which there's no evidence for that, it's extremely unlikely. You know, the Danes revere and deify their Dronning Margrethe, rather like the Thais do with their Thai king. Mm. So she's almost a living goddess, not quite on the Thai level, but I think she's such an important part of the Danish landscape and that social cohesion you have in Denmark. They all rally around her. So I don't think so.
Yeah, and I think we also have to sort of, call into question the source. I'm not sure if, the Aussie sort of women's press is, globally renowned for breaking major stories. Michael Booth in Copenhagen, very good to talk to you, as ever. Going to leave it there. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we'll be taking a trip into the meadow with author Dave Golson.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. It's 1841 here in London. Now, let me take you into the heart of rural France, where in 2003, a British author and entomologist named Dave Golson purchased a derelict farm in hope of creating a wildlife reserve for native insects. Golson's experience in the idyllic corner of France inspired him to write a book illustrating the decade he spent creating a home for butterflies, dragonflies, voles, and newts. Well, do we pay enough attention to the Earth's most minuscule creatures? And joining me now to discuss this further is Dave Golson, author of A Buzz in the Meadow, and he's also professor of biological sciences at the University of Sussex here in the UK. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, was the notion of going out to France, knowing that the end game 10 years later, that there would be a book in all of this, or was this just one of these lifestyle experiments? Because I think a lot of people can hear the first part of it saying, absolutely, it's many person's dream, anywhere along the Med, you find a nice country house, you think, okay, I'm going to take this on as a project. What was the actual starting point for it?
It most definitely wasn't to try and write a book as an end result. I never plan things that far ahead, to be honest. I just wanted to kind of have a bit of space where I could manage it for wildlife, create my own kind of wildlife reserve. And it's something also about owning the land, knowing no one else can kind of interfere or whatever. You can't afford decent-sized bits of land in Britain. It's incredibly expensive. And I've always had a bit of a love for France. I've been going on holidays there since I was 4 years old, we used to go camping every summer in France.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because there's always that, you know, that big debate, at least across the northern part of Europe, Dave, where people are sort of, you know, are you a France person? Are you a Spain person? Are you an Italy person? But that was already decided at childhood that it was
well,
for France.
Well, kind of. I love France. I love the cheese. I love the lifestyle. I wish I could speak French, and it's really embarrassing.
So where are we a decade on, or more than a decade on?
Well, so my pathetic excuse for not speaking fluent French is that despite years of doing French at school, actually having a place in France is not much help, because the place I have is in the middle of nowhere. There are no neighbours. I have to have this painful conversation once a year with the farmer who cuts the hay in my meadow, which I struggle through having kind of ginned up on, looked a few words up and whatever. But otherwise, I never get to actually speak to any French people apart from in the supermarket. So hence my French hasn't greatly improved in 10 years.
Yeah, let's get into certainly what was the driving force for the book. Were there any, you know, incentives, anything else sort of, you know, beyond the geography of the place that suggested that this was going to be a great place to set up this meadow, to create an environment for all of God's smaller creatures? There was no one from a French ministry sort of waving a check saying, go and set up a reserve.
None at all, sadly. I probably, if I could work out which form to fill in, it must be possible to get money, I suspect, for being a French farmer, but or owning a French farm anyway. But no, I never got a penny. The book is born out of something else, really. My first book, A Sting in the Tail, is about bumblebees, and I've spent the last 20 years studying bumblebees as an academic, as a scientist, and discovering all about their biology and how and they're declining, and we need to do something about that. And so I've been doing a lot of work on how we might save them. And one of the key things that bumblebees lack is that we used to have in Britain alone, 7 million hectares of flower-rich grasslands, old hay meadows and chalk downlands and so on, that were full of flowers, full of bees and lots of other wildlife. And the 20th century was a bit of a disaster as far as bees are concerned, at least. And so about 98% of those hay meadows got swept away, turned into farmland, into cereal fields and so on. And that's why our bees are declining. So the reason for buying the place in France was to try and recreate one of those hay meadows that we've lost so much of.
And is there a call to action within all of this as well for whether it is for government, whether it's people also in the private sector, that you're just going to go and buy a home in Tuscany or wherever it is in the world, that there's also a considered way of planting and thinking about your terrain?
It's not actually about a holiday home in an exotic location. Most people aren't lucky enough to have one anyway. But there is a message. Absolutely, there's a message. The message I really try and spend much of my life trying to get over to people is that we are losing our wildlife. Bees are my sort of favourite subject. And it's really easy to explain to people the importance of looking after bees. Because if we didn't have bees, we wouldn't have actually most of the things we like to eat, tomatoes, raspberries, strawberries, you name it, they're pollinated by bees. So looking after bees is really important. And most people get that. But what I've tried to highlight in my more recent book is actually we depend on a whole lot more than just bees. Actually, all these other things, many of them things that we've
done. Well, I was wondering whether you were feeling guilty that maybe the bees had too much of the spotlight. I'm wondering who else comes out, as a bit of a winner in this.
Well, they do get a lot of the spotlight. And I love bees, so I'm not too unhappy about that. But what people perhaps are less aware of is, so it's easy to explain to people why bees are important to us. It's probably less easy to explain to people why dung beetles are important, or flies, or any of the other myriad of creatures that live on this planet. But many of them are really important to us, not quite so obviously, but nonetheless, they do things that are really important. They're food for something, they help control things, they get rid of dung, they recycle nutrients, they help leaves to rot. They do all sorts of stuff that we don't appreciate, and we really need to look after them.
Well, Dave Golson, author of Buzz in the Meadow, also professor of biological science at the University of Sussex. Thanks very much for that. We should probably jump to a bit of a buzz of another kind. This is something, a much loved act here at Monocle 24. This is Tahiti 80 with Crush. Tahiti 80 there with Crush here on Midori House. Coming up almost to the top of the hour, almost 1900 here in London, at least another 9 minutes till then. And it's time to jump across the Atlantic right now, keeping it slightly musical. We're joined by Gary Trust, Associate Director of Charts and Radio at Billboard Magazine, and he is in our New York Bureau. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Excellent.
Music is good. Happy to keep the music going.
That's very good to hear. Now, just maybe tell me about the week in music. I'm always sort of intrigued what happens at this time of year because, you know, we have a gear shift, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. People sort of, you know, move away from their Adirondack chairs, etc., and they shuffle back to work. So, you know, does something happen across the month of September with charts that's particularly peculiar?
You know, I think we're still having a lot of the big summer hits are still really big. Meghan Trainor's All About That Bass is still number one in the U.S. And as I'm sure you guys have noticed, in the U.S. especially, there's a whole trend of songs about that bass. As Meghan Trainor would say, Jennifer Lopez's new song is called Booty, which doesn't it certainly gives the secret away of what the trend is. Nicki Minaj's new song as well. Yeah.
Excellent. Do we want to maybe talk a little bit about Jennifer Lopez? The rather graphically doesn't sort of leave a lot to the imagination. Booty and where this is sitting on the charts at the moment in the U.S.
Yeah, it debuted last week on the Billboard Hot 100 Songs chart at number 18, which is a really strong debut. And it probably won't come as a surprise that almost all the chart points, when we compile the chart, it's based on sales, airplay, and streaming of videos. All the points, pretty much almost all, were from the video with Jennifer Lopez and Iggy Azalea. And it's, again, given the title, it's you can guess what the video is about if you haven't seen it.
Gary, we're going to have just a very, very short listen listen to it for anyone who hasn't heard it yet. This is Ms. Lopez with Booty. Hold on tight for the ride, 'cause you know you're gonna love us. And she will indeed show you how to do it. Jennifer Lopez, Booty, there. As you said, it seemed to tick and tickle all the way out. The appropriate, am I allowed to use the word boxes? Anyway, but yes, it sounds like that is certainly what it's done on the US. I just want a little, when you see that Jennifer Lopez here has something coming out, is there sort of an office bet, that some sort of pool that goes out that says, that she's probably going to do between sort of, 20 and 15, when it hits, when you know that someone's obviously got this type of legacy?
Yeah, I mean, any artist can either have a big hit at the right time or not. It really all comes down to the song itself. But I think we've seen more in the last couple of years as streaming of videos has become much more prominent in terms of chart positions. Videos like this, our artists are finding that this is a way to get on the charts. I think it probably goes back most famously at this point last year to Miley's Wrecking Ball. Mm. I think a lot of artists who dare to go that route are finding that, yeah, video that'll get a lot of clicks is certainly a way to get attention.
Mm. Let's go. You've also selected Jeremy with "Don't Tell Him." So where is that sitting at the moment on your charts?
Yeah, that hit number 10 last week on the Billboard Hot 100. And this is actually a completely opposite case because there's actually no official video for the song. And it is pretty rare for a song nowadays to hit the top 10 on the Hot 100 without a video. So it's a testament to the song. And when you hear the hook, it should sound familiar as well.
Well, let's hopefully we'll have the hook right now. This is Don't Tell Him. Only as you got me feeling like this. Oh, why? Love it while grabbing the rhythm, your hips. That's right. Rhythm is a dancer. I need a companion. Girl, I guess that must be you. Body like the summer. Touch it like no other. Don't you tell them what we do. Well, children of the, probably early 70s, maybe even sort of late 60s, would probably identify that telltale hook. A bit of snap there, I believe, right. Gary.
Yes, from 1992 is a top five hit, so it's back in the top 10 thanks to that reworking. And what's also, I find it kind of interesting, is that Nicki Minaj is in the top 10 with Anaconda, and that samples Sir Mix-a-Lot's Baby Got Back. So there's actually two big hits from 1992 that have been reimagined into current hits. So 1992 is having a whole resurgence.
I wonder if there's any science in this as well, that that you need enough airspace between sampling something from in this case obviously we're talking sort of early 90s. Is there that sort of sense of probably familiarity, because you would have heard those songs maybe just when your parents were playing them potentially, and it all sounds sort of cozy and familiar, but in a way which becomes unique to that generation.
Right. I think you need enough time for nostalgia to kick in, and then it sounds refreshing again. You haven't heard it in so long. And also just that type of music, early 90s, there was a lot of club house music that was big. And now we're seeing songs like Clean Bandit, Rather Be, which I know is a big hit in England before it became a big hit here in the U.S. That same early 90s, real cool disco-y but modern dance music. So, yeah, things come in cycles.
Mm. We probably have just time to just hear something from I was hoping that we'd run out of time, but we may not, but we have this is a bit of U2 because we haven't seen enough of them all over television and elsewhere, and they're plugged for that rather large company from the US West Coast. This is The Miracle, and just tell us quickly about that before we get 5 seconds of it.
Right. There's been obviously a lot of controversy about the free album giveaway, which, some people obviously on one side are saying it's great that an album by a band as big as U2 is available to everyone. On the other side, it's being joked about that it's like the U2 virus. You got it on your computer, whether you want it or not. Oh. But, it's becoming a hit. The first single, the Joey Ramone song, at rock radio, adult alternative radio specifically, where U2 too has a big history, and radio programmers I've talked to say that they think it's a good song. It's as strong as the material they've been putting out in the last 10-15 years. So you know, I think at radio at least they're getting a good shot with this song.
Gary Tosh, that's absolutely brilliant. I'm glad you spoke at length, because now we don't have to play the clip, which is absolutely brilliant. That's Gary Trust, Associate Director of Charts and Radio at Billboard Magazine in New York. Thanks very much. And that's all the time we have for today's edition of Midori House. Our program was produced by Barbara Feeney and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rebecca Unger. Our studio manager has been Bill Loyte. My guests earlier in the program were John Everard and James Boyes. We've got headlines coming up at the top of the hour. Also, right after that, it's going to be this week's edition of Section D. And at 2200, it is time for the Monocle Daily. And of course, The Globalist, of course, is back tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. But for me, Tyler Brulé, have a very good afternoon, evening, and night. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.